Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is How Labs Can Adopt AI/ML Technologies Now to Drive Tangible Improvements in Care Delivery and Cost Reduction. The presenter is Brad Bostic, Chairman and CEO, HC1 Insights, Indianapolis, Indiana.
Hi, thanks for coming. Hey, Scott. Good deal. So I'm sure you guys have probably heard a lot about AI in the last couple of days. And my background, I've been in data science and AI for about 25 years now. And so it's really exciting for me to see what's happening to transform the way that work gets done. And I thought I would just talk through. By the way, if you guys have questions along the way or need clarification on anything, let me know. I tend to prefer like a discussion than sitting here and monologuing. So I'm sure Steve will have some good questions for me at some point along the way. So HC1 is out of Indianapolis. We're a data-focused company that identifies risk signals in lab data, primarily to work with improving operations, helping with better engaging the providers that you serve as a lab, and also helping inform diagnostic testing decisions. So we do precision diagnostics for health systems where people talk about lab stewardship, but specifically we're identifying under and overutilization of testing and helping to optimize that. So we do a variety of things. And these capabilities require an ability to analyze data at a scale that humans can't do. And so we've had to, by necessity, use different tools like artificial intelligence to satisfy that. Actually, John Moyer, who's on our team, should probably be giving this presentation because he's 10 times smarter than me. But I thought I'd start out with just sort of grounding everybody, though, in what's happening with AI and what some of the big personalities are saying about it. So if I can make this thing advance. Let's see here. It is not working, but I'll make it work. There we go. Okay, cool. So, some quotes that I thought were pretty powerful. Jamie Dimon, the head of the largest financial institution in the world, equates what's happening with AI. He says, think the printing press, the steam engine, electricity, computing, and the internet, like this is bigger than all of that. So it's a big deal what's going on. Sundar from Google says the impact of AI will be more profound than the invention of fire or electricity. That's a pretty big statement. I'd say fire and electricity made a pretty big impact on the world. And then we've got Elon, who says my guess is we'll have AI that's smarter than any one human probably around the end of next year. Which is interesting. I think all of us kind of know the personality of Elon Musk. And so when he's talking about, the AI being smarter than any one human, he's thinking about like the number of parameters that an AI model is trained on and able to comprehend. But the part that he kind of doesn't think about as much is that, AI inherently lacks a lot of what humans can bring to the table. And I'll talk about that a bit more because I don't think that AI will replace all of our jobs, but I do think that AI will make all of the healthcare leaders and clinicians able to perform at a much higher level than what they can do without the assist of the AI. So we believe at HC1 big time in leveraging AI to enable every laboratory and every pathologist to sort of play at the highest level that they possibly can and use their time much more efficiently. But I thought I'd just do a little bit of grounding in what these numbers mean. So everybody knows OpenAI and the company and ChatGPT. Raise your hands if you use ChatGPT, like in general. Yeah? And so it was interesting when I was preparing for this presentation, I thought, hey, I'd like to create an infographic. And so I told ChatGPT what I wanted it to create. And then there's a thing called DALL-E, which is one of the models that's actually for creating, graphics. and it produced like a really wacky infographic. So it was definitely the case that it had like a pile of money in the middle, and like I was trying to convey this concept of all these different parts of AI and how it can impact healthcare. So that didn't quite work out yet. But so think about the parameters though within a GPT, within a generative AI model, as like neurons, you know, and so you think about like different animals have different numbers of neurons, and the human brain's about 86 billion neurons. And it's not a one for one, of course, in terms of the idea of parameters, but you can see it's sort of like the same concept as Moore's law, where ChatGPT-3 had 175 billion parameters. ChatGPT-4 has 1.76 trillion parameters. So, you know, each one of these times you hear about like a new GPT coming out, it's effectively, you know, 10xing over time. And so it's pretty exciting. But the thing about these AI models is that they always sound sure, but they're not always right. You know, so and so like you can ask I asked the question, what's the largest high school basketball gym in the United States? And I have lived in Indiana much of my adult life, which is huge about basketball. And I know that Greencastle, Indiana has actually the biggest stadium, and it came out with the biggest high school basketball stadiums in California, and it seats, you know, whatever. And it was much smaller than what I knew was the biggest one, but it sounded really like it was really sure. You know what I mean? And it behaves like a human. And so you kind of assume that it's thinking like a human, but in reality, it's really just ingesting loads of different data. And it's like today where GPT is, it's really just like modern search, you know, but you ask it a question more of a human way. As an interesting side note, I, have been in pursuit of this kind of vision of ask anything and get the answer back since I started a company back in, 2005 that was called ChaCha. And it actually allowed you to ask any question on your mobile phone, and then it would respond through a combination of human intelligence and AI, where we had actual, like, a network of humans, like hundreds of thousands of them, where if a question got routed to our system through text was the main interface, if the system didn't know the answer with high confidence, it would route to a human who would then answer the question, and then that would end up in the database, and there was kind of a scoring in the background so we knew the answer was correct. So, you know, back then it was kind of cool. You could say, how many eyelids does a camel have, for example? Does anybody know the answer, by the way? The answer's three. Yeah, she knew. So in any event, they've got these, you know, really cool evolved eyelids that work well in the desert. So in any event, we created that, and it was pretty cool. We got up to about 28 million monthly unique users, which was the biggest tech service in the world at the time. And, you know, we kind of saw this vision and where it was going. But now that you've got, you know, GPT that's as advanced and accessible as it is, you don't have to roll all that from scratch. But I think it's important, though, just to remind ourselves that just because it sounds like it's sure, it might not be right. And in healthcare, it's a big problem, you know, right? So I think it's important for the humans to still make the decisions and to be training these. And there's this idea of human feedback, you know, continuously in making the AI better. And I think that's kind of the big opportunity that we have in healthcare. Oops, wrong direction. So this is where Elon's comment about how AI will be smarter than the smartest human, like, misses the point of kind of humanity. In order for AI to actually get to the point where it's you know, more human, it has to understand something that computers can't understand now, which is like human emotion, you know, and think about, you know, healthcare is obviously a really personal thing. And I think the humans, you know, are obviously critical in that. And, you know, interestingly, we've been having a lot of conversations at this conference about how important it is to put the pathologist in the center of healthcare delivery in a strategic way, instead of just having the pathologist be this hidden thing that most people don't even realize they're there. And it's crazy. You know, why is it that the radiologist who reads the MRI is front and center, but the pathologist who's doing this really critical work in order to identify what kind of, you know, specific cancer you have and how you're going to be treated, why are they sort of in the background? So I actually think this is like this AI, this emergence of AI is presenting a really cool opportunity for pathology and laboratory to actually become more of a central feature of the healthcare continuum. And I think using these tools effectively which we'll talk about some specific examples, can afford us the chance to actually play that role, you know, in laboratory medicine. And the reason I started HC1 to begin with was because I had been working in interoperability, and I had started a teleradiology company, and I'd kind of seen a lot of different aspects of healthcare, and it blew me away that lab was informing so much of what healthcare is, and the decisions that are made to treat people, but the lab result would just kind of go to a given clinician and then get filed into, you know, a record somewhere and never really leveraged again. I mean, it just didn't make any sense to me. And as I have continued down this path, I've realized, you know, that it's been about a 12-year journey for HC1 at this point, and we're still just getting started, I think. But the opportunity to make lab data really come to life and be used more to deliver value and be used better to ensure that people are on the right medications and have the right treatment plans. Like, this is all possible now because AI is here, you know, because there's not enough time in the day for us to go sort through all this data manually. But there are some really powerful things that we can do, you know, with this data now, because the technology can help power us up. So then there's this other side of healthcare. I gave a talk last year here about AI, and I used the 2001 A Space Odyssey. Have you seen that movie? So there's this HAL 9000, and he goes haywire, and the computer is basically controlling this mission to space that's like into deep space, and this they go through some kind of like an energy field, and it like hoses HAL, and HAL realizes that he's like not working properly, and because he couldn't figure out like the right way to do things, his solution was like just to kill the crew, you know? Like, and so he was like, look, you know, this isn't going well. I don't really know what to do now. So I better just kill these guys off, because, you know, then I can just do my thing. And so, you know, there is, I think, some danger. You know, it's kind of interesting how prophetic that, movie was. It was made like in the 60s. So there was also a study that was recently, commissioned out of, Japan, and this gentleman runs the largest telecommunications company there, and his company's study said in the worst case scenario, democracy and social order could collapse, resulting in wars, which is true. I mean, if you think about what AI could do if it were to go, you know, the wrong direction, it could just create all kinds of problems. Like, think about cybersecurity is a big topic, right? And so you have like humans that are figuring out how to fish into your system and hack you and whatever, you know, take that times a billion, because you could actually make AI behave that way, like where it's emailing with your staff and, you know, kind of doing different things to try to find its way in. So I think we have to be smart about how it is that we're applying AI to avoid this. So there's all this hype, though, and a lot of really exciting opportunities. I do believe ultimately, you know, things will actually be better as a result of AI. I do think that we'll have the kinds of checks and balances needed in order to use it properly. And I think innovative people are going to come up with really incredible ways to make AI actually improve healthcare. So here's an example of where AI actually has made a huge impact on a business. There's this company, Klarna, and they have this AI assistant that has actually replaced 700 service jobs. So if you need service from Klarna, you actually can interact with this chat bot that's really feels human, and it doesn't require you to actually talk to somebody in their call center, which is pretty incredible. I actually believe that when you are interacting with a chat bot that's AI, that there should be some requirement or precedent where you know that that's actually not a human. I don't know about you guys, but it feels kind of crazy to think you might be talking to some type of an AI that makes you think you're talking to a human. I was actually talking about this yesterday, another just kind of, you know, potential, impact of AI just on humanity. So imagine taking, let's say you have a grandfather that passes away, or a parent, and you take all of the video and all the images and all of the messages and everything that that person had ever, you know, created or you've created about them, and you fed that into an AI that actually could then like simulate that person, right? I mean, that's a possibility that, it's kind of crazy. I think it's, also probably could be pretty dangerous to have that kind of thing, but these are possible. I mean, today you can actually use an AI system that will actually sound like you and, could call your family and say, I'm been taken hostage or whatever. Like, this is stuff that's happening now. So it's pretty crazy. So getting into why do we care about this? What does it mean to labs today? Because there's all this like cool dystopian and innovative stuff that could happen. But like, who cares? Right? I mean, we have to run labs. We have to deliver healthcare. How do we make it so we can do that better with AI? So first of all, people use the term AI in a million different ways. And I thought it would be good just to say, like, what is AI? So everybody, I think, probably knows what data science is, which is extracting insights from data generally for business or for research. Usually it combines math, statistics, and artificial intelligence and computer engineering to analyze large amounts of data. So that's what data science is. And really, artificial intelligence is just a way to make machines create, inform and make decisions more like humans do. So, it's like a smarter way to use technology. And then machine learning is like just a branch of artificial intelligence that focuses on making the system smarter over time based on the data that you feed it. And so ultimately it, imitates the way humans learn. But also it only knows what it gets fed. So if it gets fed bad data, it's going to be giving you bad answers and it won't get smarter. It'll get, more confused. And people talk about like hallucinations is one term that's used, which I think is somewhat of a, good way to put it, but it's effectively going to tell you something that's totally wrong and, you'll think it's right. So, you're running a lab, you've got all these humans and you've got providers and patients that are depending on you and all things are possible. But also it's hard to figure out where to start. And so some of the things that we've seen, where there's a lot of value in artificial intelligence and machine learning to your lab. So we generally see that automating diagnostic processes to identify hidden risks and personalized treatment plans, that's very possible today. So if you think about the things that humans have to do that are just sort of repetitive, where if they get smarter about how they're doing it, they can do it faster and more efficiently. We're seeing AI, play a role there. In fact, one of the kind of cool things that our team has built at HC1 is a workforce optimization solution that John presented on this morning, where it basically takes all of your lab orders and results, and it takes all of your staff information, and the system constantly analyzes the patterns and the trends, and based on a whole huge amount of training data, gives you actual suggestions. So it's not an analytic that you just look at a chart. It actually is saying, like a person would, hey, we need to make these changes in order to optimize the way we're staffing, and it helps with all manners of operational performance and profitability as well. And obviously staffing is really a hard thing. And so not as sexy as, a lot of these other far-flung, interesting ideas, but something that is really powerful. The other thing we've seen that's pretty cool is predicting patient outcomes and disease progression. So we've actually created an AI model that, based on customary routine lab testing, can predict with very high accuracy who's most predisposed for cognitive decline down the road, so Alzheimer's. And there are these really exciting new treatments that help to slow cognitive decline. But once you've had Alzheimer's for a while, which normally people get diagnosed when they've sort of had a lot of cognitive decline already, and physicians haven't wanted to diagnose it because there's nothing that they could do about it anyway. Well, now that you can do something about it, but the sooner you're ahead of the curve, the better, you actually can tell based on these routine lab test data points that only AI can figure out, because it's way too much data, who needs to be monitored for that, which is pretty cool. And we're actually working with Lilly right now on that initiative, which is in our backyard in Indianapolis. So that's kind of exciting, because you think about, how can the lab actually truly save lives and improve people's lives? Well, there's so much gold in that data that exists, and there's so much that we're going to continue to find. So that's kind of a cool example. And then there's also just identifying patterns that allow you to make better clinical decisions, and really move from this sort of turnaround time focused approach to more of the lab of the future, where you can use this kind of technology to become a closer partner with the entire health ecosystem. And I don't know why you might wear a really fun suit like this, but it looks fashionable. But in any event, I think that what we're finding is labs are becoming more of a strategic center point in healthcare, and with these AI tools, they can do more to be more efficient and more effective. So there's this idea of the digital twin as well that I see as a key part of what AI can enable, which is, rather than experimenting on humans, why not have these models that are digital that you can actually sort of test out, hey, what is the best medication or what is the best treatment plan? And so we've done a fair amount of work in this space where instead of the data that you're generating about a patient just being, a record you're looking at in a static way, where you can actually build out digitally what the patient looks like sort of as a composite and say, hey, if I have this person who has these test results and has these certain behaviors or treatment plan, what is the most likely outcome? What's the thing that's going to give us the best chance for this person to be well? My mom died of colon cancer, and she was, back then, I don't think really anybody was doing pharmacogenetic testing. And she actually ended up getting overdosed on this chemotherapy. The doctor, the oncologist said, and that's why she passed away. And she would have died anyway, but the doctor was like, wow, I've never seen somebody, respond to this chemo like that. And I'm like, well, that's helpful. It's a little late now. But so it would have been nice to have a digital twin where you could have said, hey, this person has all these different things going on, and this is what the treatment is we're going to give them. And the actual digital twin can let you simulate what it is that's going to happen. That's cool. That changes everything. I want my doctor to do that. Let's see here. Am I going the right way? Yeah, so just thinking about, AI and ML in terms of the opportunities, things like predictive analytics, and the immediate value of that is really enhanced diagnostic precision. In the future, we'll have AI-driven personalized medicine that does use this concept of a digital twin. We've got data analysis and interpretation today. It does things like reducing turnaround time, and ultimately we see a big opportunity to leverage genomics more proactively. And then we've got, lab workflow optimization that generates cost savings and also gives you a chance to use predictive analytics in a way that gets you ahead of the curve. If you look at healthcare today, we're very much trial and error, where you've got, this, we're reacting, we're necessarily treating people who are already sick. And in the future, we see this chance that you can actually get ahead of the curve, predict where people are going with their care, and be really proactive about that. And I think there's also a lot, more that we can do to leverage these kinds of insights to make it so that there's a real link to value-based care. And I know I've heard some people say, I don't really see value-based care. And I get that as it relates to today the labs aren't getting paid, on that basis. But I think to the extent we can show that our labs are driving outcomes, in a better way, which I think AI gives you the chance to do that really effectively, you're going to be able to get paid more. You're ultimately going to be a more strategic part of the healthcare system. And when I talk to a health system executive, even at the C-suite, and you say, are you interested in leveraging your lab as a strategic asset? Everybody says, yeah, but they don't really know how. And so to the extent that you can be leveraging this data and using AI to deliver on this better, more complete, more accurate approach to how you deliver care, I think ultimately you're going to be more front and center, right? So if you're in the boardroom and you're not just talking about turnaround time, you're talking about, hey, we understand better than anybody what's happening with the patient journey. We understand what we need to be doing to treat patients more effectively. We're collaborating with how we're delivering on the medication therapies. All of a sudden, I think you end up in the center of this in a really good way. Oh, wow, it worked. So just some additional examples. Within lab operations, there's sort of this idea of having a co-pilot, which have you guys heard that term for, with AI? So there's sort of a, it's like a series of prompts, And so you're not just asking it a question like GPT. It's sort of organizing the way that it's taking the information from you. And with a co-pilot, you can do some pretty powerful things. One of the things that we've seen is we've got a co-pilot that allows you to basically interrogate these different data sets to find different patterns and information about your patients. So, it'll prompt you with a few different questions and then come back with a really curated response from your data that historically would have taken like a week and, you know, three analysts to go find. And it takes minutes, which is pretty cool. From a clinical decision support standpoint, we also see like identifying the analytes for miscellaneous testing, where you'll see a test will come through and it's in this miscellaneous bucket, and it takes a bunch of labor and effort, and sometimes you just miss even being able to bill for it. So we're using AI now to solve that. So the test will come through, and based on certain, you know, parameters and what the AI knows, it'll actually say like, this is the test, that which can then be billed and obviously used more effectively. We're using this for precision diagnostics as well, where we identify what tests really should be applied to different patients, and that's a pretty heavy ML kind of capability. And then you can see, you know, on a pop health perspective, things like I mentioned earlier, the Alzheimer's disease detection, which is pretty cool, and Lilly is an amazing company, and they have all these brilliant people, and it's been really fun to see the eyes open for these super senior clinical experts on like, wow, we had no idea that based on routine laboratory testing, if we use this kind of model, it allows us to get ahead of the curve and get patients enrolled sooner in these processes to monitor what's going on with their health. Getting into where is this going in terms of the strategies that you can employ? First of all, you have to have a great way to take the data and make it useful. So the AI is only going to be as good as the training that you do, right? And so if you don't have data to train on, you don't have a good model. And it's easy to get an AI model. It's not easy to get one that's actually trained in a way that's going to produce value. And so one of the things we've done at HC1 is really focus on, I think it's, we've had somewhere around 70 billion lab orders and results flow through our platform. And we take this sort of aggregate of that to train these models so they get smarter and smarter to the benefit of all of our clients. And it allows you to have all kinds of solutions to sit on top of that. I think, you know, the clinical lab 2.0 doesn't just think about turnaround time. It thinks about, what am I doing to drive the best possible care for the patient? How am I becoming more proactive? And I think ultimately the pathologist starts becoming like a central figure in this whole process because of AI. Another huge issue that we see is with compendia. So I think everybody in here probably has seen that problem of like, you've got one test code over here and another one over there, and they seem like they should be the same, but they have different analytes that are included. And so it's not actually the same test, especially when you're dealing with health systems. And so what we've been able to do is actually automate that. So if you're a big lab that's acquiring other labs and you need to get on a standard test compendium, that's a great use case for that. Or if you're doing a lot of business with health systems where you need to somehow match your test menu up with their test menu, using this machine learning and AI solution, it doesn't take legions of humans to have to do that work, which is pretty exciting. So this is something I won't read to you, but you can get access to this presentation afterward if you're interested. But really, it's an evolutionary process. So it's not like overnight we're all of a sudden going to have AI that changes the world for our labs. But I think it's, you know, taking one step at a time. So if you start with, hey, I'd like to optimize my staffing, you know, I mean, just start with something, right? And the cool thing about that example is, it doesn't have any impact on the clinical decision making yet, you know, which is kind of a big leap, but it's a good place to start. This is just a way to think about the lab performance maturity model. So we think about like step one, we try to meet labs that we partner with wherever they are, right? And so like in many cases, you start with this data fundamentals where, the lab will have a lab information system and maybe a lot of spreadsheets and some kind of analytics that they're doing, but they don't have an actual sort of data model that would provide for the kind of training that you need for ML and AI. From there, we tend to see people focus on their operations and understanding, having this cockpit where they really can drive their business, lead, manage, and hold people accountable more effectively because they have the data underlying and the analytics there. And then putting workflows in place that help drive decisions. So it's not just, how do I look at another report? I'm sure everybody has plenty of those. It's how do I actually drive decisions based on the data that I've got. And in order to do that, you have to have good data. It has to be organized effectively. And then it kind of builds from there. And you know, ultimately, you can start getting into this more predictive world where you're changing the way the future plays out versus just understanding what's happening right now in order to take action. So, you know, in terms of the formula, it's really starting with the data, ensuring that you're optimizing your resources, which are scarce, and starting to improve your financial and operational performance, really advancing that then into the point where you can start implementing much more advanced programs with these kinds of strategies. Sometimes it works. So that is all I had in the way of slides, and I was really hopeful that some folks would have questions or even thoughts or ideas, and I'd be curious to know if anybody is currently using AI that you're aware of, or, you know, is it important to you? Do you have any examples? Yeah, so Steve asked the question here, with recency bias and the amount of data that it takes to actually create this more holistic approach to decision making, how as a lab do you use this in a way that doesn't potentially backfire, I guess is sort of what you're asking. And so in my experience, this whole idea of human reinforced AI is the way to go. And it's making it clear to whoever the people are that are using these tools that, hey, this is just a way to help augment the information that you have available to you, but you still need to make the decision. And then ultimately, you know, when the system's designed the right way, those human decisions end up smoothing off the rough edges that you're talking about, because people are still using their brains, which is important. And I think that's the risk probably is that people get less vigilant about the decisions they're making, and they, like your example of recency bias or the question, it's, you know, if you get into this situation where the model is sort of making the wrong recommendation and you're not really thinking it through, and then ultimately you could harm patients, you know, with that. And so I think it's over time. The other thing that I think works well is if you have sort of a stewardship approach where you're doing like a peer review, you know, and you're kind of looking at, hey, what have we done and how has this affected our decisions? And that way it's more than just like a person looking at that data. But it's a huge problem and a huge risk. And I think that's the value of having, you know, a real cloud kind of architecture where you're ingesting billions and billions versus just what any one healthcare location could do. And that certainly helps to make the model much more accurate. Yeah. No, Alex was just pointing out that with large language models, you can end up with this sort of drift where it misinforms you. So the other thing, though, to that point is GPT, which is the thing that people generally are experiencing, is ingesting all the data on the internet. And so it's effectively giving you this super broad array of information and answers, whereas if I'm training a model on test compendia in order to make it so it's telling me, you know, this is the same test as that is, or it's allowing me to ask the question about who are the patients that meet, you know, certain criteria for a clinical trial, for example, it's trained on like a much narrower, deeper data set, and it's being reviewed by experts who actually know the information. But if you look up like human reinforced AI, I think that's exactly the point here. It's this doesn't replace humans, especially not in clinical care. But it does, if it's trained the right way on the right data, it helps power people up. Right. Yeah, and Curtis is with American Oncology Network. He's just commenting that, and they've started with Workforce Advisor, which is this HC1 AI that identifies recommendations for your staffing, and which, as it turns out, is more difficult than what it seems like it could or should be. And it's a good showcase where you're starting with an operational aspect where humans were having to do a lot of shuffling. Now they can allocate that time more to let's make the best decisions, and ultimately it generates more efficiency and more profit. Yes? Yeah, the question is, what data do you need? How much do you need? And at what point can you justify making an investment to be participating in the benefits of AI? So to start with that last question, I would say about the size. I mean, one of the beauties of where we are now is you don't have to make some huge cash investment in order to get started. You know, these tools are very efficient now. It used to take a massive effort and a whole bunch of data scientists, and now you go get a tool from AWS and you know, you create software that, that can deliver on some kind of a use case. In terms of the amount of data that you need, and so I would say any size. I mean, because at every size, you want to figure out how I can be more efficient and how I can better focus my resources. And you know, I know we chatted a little bit earlier about this. The volume of data, certainly the quality of the data matters a ton, you know, and the structure of the data and how you're using that to train, and then having the sort of human feedback loop. Any kind of a model that you're going to get from like a credible vendor partner is going to, by necessity, be trained on sufficient data in order to help solve your problem, but or help make you more efficient, or help you, you know, target who you want to sell to more, or whatever it is that you're trying to do. So I can't really, you know, give you a quantification, but I know in our case we've trained these models on, you know, tens of billions of lab results and orders, and they continue to be trained. And then having the expertise in order to make sure that you're inspecting what you expect coming out of the system is critical. But I think any size, and I don't think an individual practice is necessarily going to be the best position to go roll some kind of new model from scratch and do all this training, and unless you're pretty sizable, right? I mean, because you have to have some kind of a data analyst team and folks who really know how to do the validation of the model. So I think really you can get started at any time and benefit from the fact that you're going to work with a partner that's already trained the model. Does that make sense? And then ultimately it becomes more specialized for your needs based on how you use it. And that's the other thing about, you know, the way AI works is, machine learning works, is the more that you use it and give input back into it, the more it's going to get tuned into what it is that you want to get out of it. So the comment was, and question was about how you manage to leverage AI for clinical decision support, knowing that it's could potentially be missing something or going in the wrong direction. And the only answer I'd give you to that is, one, I think for clinical decision making, where it's like a multivariate situation that requires a whole bunch of medical training, I think the very best you can expect is it's sort of like search, you know, where if you go to Google and you search something, you're still going to kind of verify it and go to where the source is. And I just got the stop sign, so thanks for that. I saw you. So the final comment I'll make is, I think ultimately you just need to be careful, just like you would with search, to recognize that this is just like a supplemental. It's like going through the textbook and realizing, you know, hey, sometimes the science changes, you know, and things get updated, and the textbook you're referencing, you know, might not be accurate. So it's like a turbocharged way to access that literature, I think, faster and better. And then the other thing I would say is it relates to clinical decision support. If you're looking at information that's coming up that's kind of from peer-reviewed, you know, sources that you trust, you can actually link back to, like, what is the source of this? You know, so any good model that relates to clinical decision support, I think, would help you in that way. Right, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, and I know we have to wrap. I really appreciate you folks coming. And if you have any other questions for me, you can find me on LinkedIn, just Bradley Bostic. And, you know, any of our team members would love to chat if you guys have ideas you'd like to explore. So thanks. Have a great conference. Take care.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.